You've been here now for some time. Chapter 27. I don't know how many weeks it's been since we started talking about the Passion Week, but it's been quite a while. We're taking our time. We're working through here little by little, understanding that we've been through probably all these scriptures many times before. And at the same time, we understand there's always new things to be learned and new things to be understood and for us to grab hold of. We are in 27, and we are at verse 7. Before we do this, let me remind you of where we're at right here. This is Jesus has been arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, bound, and as he was betrayed by Judas. Taken to the house of Caiaphas, where he underwent a kangaroo court trial and was charged then as being worthy of death, his crimes, basically being blasphemy in their eyes because he made himself out to be God. He's been taken to Pilate now, and he stands before Pilate, and we understand this was absolutely necessary because the Jews could not execute anyone, even if they found them worthy of a crime that was worthy of death. And so they have taken Jesus now to Pilate, the Roman governor. And we know that none of these men really had a very moral reputation in their time among the people. The people didn't like Pilate. The people, the average person, didn't really care much for the high priests either of Caiaphas or Annas. Because obviously they were men that used their position for their own betterment, not really what it was supposed to be used for. But Jesus now has been taken to Pilate, and these charges have been brought against him. We also know this, that details are given to us about Judas, that there was remorse on the part of Judas, and that he tried to return the 30 pieces of silver, as we talked about last week. And funny how the priests at that time, they were very willing to give it to him, but they wouldn't take it back because it was tainted money, because now it was blood money. And he had taken those coins and thrown them into the treasury of the temple, and then Judas had gone out and hung himself. And that's where we are as we pick up with verse 7. And they conferred together, and with the money bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. So they're kind of caught in a difficult position here, if you want to call it that, that they brought upon themselves, by the way. But here's this money. What are we going to do with this money? And you need to understand that all these men were greedy men. They were very wealthy men. But they come up with this idea that what they will do is they will buy the potter's field and use it for a place to bury strangers. Now, that sounds like a good and noble thing that they're doing there. It sounds like they're putting the money maybe to good use. One of the amazing things is really that maybe should strike us is they didn't take the money back themselves. They knew there was something wrong with it. They knew that it was blood money and it couldn't be used for something other than something that was holy. I was thinking about these guys last week and wondering just how well they knew their Bible. And when you consider some of the things that they've done, you have to come to the conclusion that they really didn't. Either they didn't know the Bible very well, or they knew what the Bible said and they just didn't care what it said. And reality is probably there was some of both of those in this mix. You ever hear of the seven deadly sins? Find those in Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 through 19. Let me just read these for you. There are six things which the Lord hates. Yes, seven which are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises evil or wicked plans, feet that run rapidly to evil, a false witness who utters lies, and one who spreads strife among brothers. Now, doesn't it seem as though they were breaking every one of those sins and all that they've been doing here? Just an example of how blind people can be to their own sin. Why now would they buy this field? It's hard to say. But we know what it's like sometimes to have ideas that seem to be very godly, and at the same time, at the very root, they're as ungodly as you possibly can be. But the point of the fact is this, is they've condemned the acts of Judas in all of this. But at the same time, they've justified their own. Are we guilty of the same kind of thing sometimes? I would imagine that I am, and if I am, I'm pretty confident that probably you are too. Right? Something we have in common. And what I want to say is that there are times when it seems that even very wicked, evil people do things that on the surface look like they may be have some goodness about them. Is it important for them to have a burial place for strangers, people that came there? Very often they may have been people that have come to Jerusalem to worship during the Passover, and they died in the meantime, and they need a place to be buried. Goes on to tell us this, therefore the field is called the field of blood to this day. It's also called that in Acts chapter 1, verse 19, where it talks about Judas going out and killing himself. The field of blood. In other words, this field would become a place that would remind people when they pass by there of how the money came to buy that property for that graveyard. Become known as the field of blood. Most of you don't know this, or some of you may not know this, but there's a little note of notoriety given to a little place called Akawaha, Florida. Okay, does anyone know? Most of you know where it is, or some of you know where it is, you don't know. But all of you probably recognize the name Bonnie and Clyde, right? Those names back from the 20s and the times of those gangs that went around, those criminal gangs that went around and did so much. There actually was a lady named Mar Barker who, her and her sons, they were of the same kind of thing. And they had actually come to Akawaha back in 1935, and they were living in a house in Akawaha. We stayed down there in the summertime when I was in high school a couple of summers, and we were just a few houses down from that house. And the thing that house is noted for after all this time, and that was 35 years after it took place, it's still people that live around it still know what house you're talking about when they say that is the house that Ma Barker was killed in back in the 1935. I actually met a woman one time who knew them. They said that her and her sons were very kind to the people in Akawaha. They'd go in and get gas, and they'd always give a big tip to the person that pumped their gas. And all that kind of stuff. But the point I'm trying to make is this, is sometimes name tags are placed on things that go on for a long, long period of time. And so there's memories that are associated with those. And so you need to understand something. That people that were familiar with all of the things that took place with Jesus and all the things that took place with Judas, probably for some years as they passed that field, they would think of what some of them knew to be the greatest betrayal of all time that was memorialized in that field. Verse 9, at that time, the word spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price set by the sons of Israel. Now, let me tell you guys, if you've done your homework, you might understand that we might have a little bit of a problem here. The problem is this, is the quotation comes from the book of Zechariah, chapter 11, verse 13, not from Jeremiah. Oh my goodness, the Bible's got an error. What are you going to do with that? Seriously, did Matthew make a mistake here? He's writing down his gospel. He meant to say Zechariah. He accidentally said Jeremiah. What do you think? What would you do if someone came to you and said, you know, you talk about this Bible, how inerrant it is and all that other kind of stuff. Let me show you an error, and it's right there, and you can't deny that it's an error in your Bible. Explain it to me. What are you going to do with it? Well, one thing you can say is this. It sounds a whole lot like Zechariah 11, but it also sounds a whole lot like Jeremiah chapter 19. And really what we're seeing here is Matthew taking two prophecies and kind of melding them, blending them together. And he only makes mention of Jeremiah. Who, remember, is one of those major prophets. Zechariah is considered to be a minor prophet, less known, less influential, and all those kinds of things. That could simply be all that's taking place here. You need to understand that. But you need to be aware of these things. Because if you're not, you can get caught without anything to say. Verse 11, one of the things I want you to note here is this, is with all the verbs and things that are used here, you need to understand something. It doesn't necessarily come across in the English translation. And then what we're looking at here is a great deal of intensity in all of the action verbs and things that are taking place here. And we're going to see this just as we begin to read here. But Jesus stood in front of the governor, and he questioned him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said, "It is as you say." Now, when we stood, we just think, well, Jesus just stood there. Now, we need to remember some things, that Jesus has been beaten pretty badly at this point already. He's been hit in the face with fists repeatedly. In other words, he would have been on his way to the emergency room if it was you or me. In other words, what I'm saying here, guys, is by this time, it was probably getting difficult for Jesus to do some things, and one of those is stand. You need to understand that he wasn't standing voluntarily. He was standing here, and this is what the verb tells us. He was forced to stand. He was made to stand. And when they ask him, or when he was asked, "Are you the king of the Jews?" It wasn't some casual asking. It wasn't like you were asking someone what the weather's going to be like today, or what they're doing after church today. This is the kind of asking, guys, that demands, it commands an answer to it. The Gospel of John lets us understand a lot more of what's going on at this particular time. In chapter 18, he enlightens us to particular aspects of things. One of those is this, is that Jesus, when he had been taken to the Roman governor, had been taken inside the praetorium, but the Jews would not go inside because they did not want to make themselves unclean because they still had to celebrate the Passover. And you understand there's some distance now between his accusers and Jesus. And what you see with Pilate, he goes kind of from one place to the other place, talking to Jesus for a while. Then he goes out and talks with the Jews for a while. That's what's going on here. And there's a conversation that takes place between Pilate inside the praetorium. This is how things are elaborated on in the Gospel of John. Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus said, yeah, it is as you say. And then Jesus continues. He says, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. And Pilate says there, so you are a king. And Jesus responds, you say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. And Pilate says at that point, what is truth? We get this idea sometimes, and I'm sure that this probably came across to the Jewish leaders who had brought Jesus there, and it almost seems like times that Pilate's kind of trying to wiggle out of this whole thing. Does that mean that Pilate's been nice to Jesus? No. Doesn't mean that at all. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the Jews hate Pilate, and Pilate hates the Jews, and he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to have Jesus executed because he doesn't want to do these guys any favors. The truth is, if Pilate was a just and merciful man at this point, he would have arrested his captors and had them under trial because of the way that they treated their prisoner. When he was being charged by the chief priests and elders, he did not answer. Need to understand, this is the point that the Romans are bringing formal charges against Jesus. How do children typically behave when a charge is brought against them? Sometimes they will admit to the wrongdoing. Is that the normal thing? It is for some kids. But in general, we would know that probably not. We know that they will make feeble attempts to convince mom or dad that they really are not to blame for whatever happened. It was really not their doing. Blame shifting. It wasn't me, it was Susie, my little sister. Where did that come from? Well, let me tell you guys, it came from the Garden of Eden. Because when they were confronted with their sin, what did Adam and Eve do? Well, Adam tried to blame it on Eve, and Eve tried to blame it on the serpent. Sometimes people play the victim. It's not really my fault. The things went the way they did. I tried to stop them. As a matter of fact, I was trying to be the solution to this, and it really became a problem because of what other people did, not me. Sometimes people try to justify their actions. Sometimes kids try to make deals. Right? You've done it. Just let me go this one time, Mom and Dad, then I promise. I will never, ever do it again. Only to turn around and do it again in a day or two. Sometimes it comes down to outright lying. So where does this come by with little children? Well, there's a sense in which it's just simply their sinful nature. But at the same time, they learn a great deal of what they do from their parents. Very often, they're doing the same thing that they've heard Mom and Daddy do. Justifying wrong actions on their part. Knowing people like we know people, we know there are not very many people who would take the approach that Jesus did here. Not many people are going to stand silently by while people throw all kinds of slanderous charges and language against them that's not true, that they're absolutely innocent of. What is our gut reaction when it comes to stuff like that? It's to speak out, it's to defend ourselves, right? There's something in us that drives us to do that. But here we have Jesus standing here absolutely silent. Not offering any kind of self-defense whatsoever. This is not at all what Pilate expected. Not at all. He's used to people begging him, groveling in a sense at his feet, to be lenient, to be merciful. Could Jesus have defended himself? Yeah. But he didn't. And that leaves us with a question. And that question is why? Well, there's a lot of things we can think. There's some things we can say about that, but we understand this. That he had no desire to self-defend himself. For a reason. And the reason he had to be found guilty as charged. Remember Isaiah 53, verse 7, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth like a lamb that is led to slaughter, like a sheep that is silent before its shearers. So he did not open his mouth. Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" I haven't seen anybody mention a jury here anywhere. We need to understand something, and that is that Pilate had the power granted him by Rome of life and death. In other words, Jesus' life was in his hands at this point. At least this is the way he's looking at it. This is perspective on things. And we need to understand something, that he was not the best judge there ever was, that he actually had done some very horrible things in his life already. We mentioned already that Jesus had mentioned at one time that Pilate had mixed the blood of some of the pilgrims that had come to offer their sacrifices with the temple with the blood of the sacrifices. He was an evil man. But he was both judge and executioner. He had the authority to let Jesus go free. Have you tried to defend yourself? How did it work for you? I would imagine more often than not, your self-defense probably just dug your hole a little bit deeper. Am I right? How do you say something to someone who refuses to defend themselves? What do you say to them? Because it's not at all what you expect to get from them. You expect to get all that stuff that we talked about before. By this time, the Jews are continuing to add charges to all of this, just to encourage, because they don't want Pilate to wiggle out of this. And I think from the very beginning, they have some sense he's going to try to do that. So they're trying to build their case as much as they can. And so they begin to just throw things, accusations based upon nothing. Let me give an example of this. Luke chapter 23, verse 2. We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar and saying that he himself is Christ, a king. Now, the last part is true, right? First part's not true. How do we know that? Because in Matthew 22, verse 21, we read this. This is where the Herodians had come to Jesus in the temple at the beginning of the very week. It's not like it was months ago or years ago. It was just a few days ago. The Herodians have come to challenge Jesus, trying to trap him in some kind of a word game. And what they said to him was, tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to give a poll tax to Caesar or not? And Jesus obviously said, no, don't give taxes to Caesar. Is that what he said to the people? No. What Jesus said was this, show me the coin used for the poll tax. And he brought him a denarius, and he said, whose likeness and inscription is this? They said, Caesar's. And he said, then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. Jesus actually encouraged them to pay taxes to the Romans. You see how baseless all of these charges are? And we know that every single one of them is a false charge. All of them. Except the fact that he claims to be the Christ, which is the truth. Because it's the truth. Right? And he, that's Jesus, did not answer him pertaining to what he said. So the governor was utterly astonished. Not just plainly astonished, not just amazed, but utterly, absolutely, totally astonished that he would stand in silence. Remember, there's no court of appeals here. I mean, this is the time for the Jews to build their case, but at the same time, it's the time for Jesus to build his defense case. And he doesn't do it at all. Jesus is silent because he chooses to be. The next time you find yourself in a position where you feel like you have to defend yourself, try it. Don't say a word. You know what happens most of the time? People don't know what to do with it because it's not what they expect. Sometimes it's best not to say anything. Very often it's best, as a matter of fact, not to say anything. Pilate's court is convened, but we need to understand something. There's a higher court that's being convened at the same time. God's court in heaven. Why is Jesus where he is? Why is he in the predicament that he's in? It's because God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit agreed that all of this would take place in absolute detail. Jesus stands falsely accused and innocent before Pilate's court for one reason, and that is because each one of us is exceedingly guilty in God's court. Apart from what Jesus does for us. In other words, Jesus must be declared guilty and the sentence be carried out that we might be declared innocent and our death sentence overturned. You ever try to defend yourself to God? You ever had the audacity of saying to him, well, you just don't understand this particular situation, Lord. Let me explain it to you. You ever tried to do something like that? Do you realize how ridiculous that whole thing is? And yet we feel compelled to do it very often. But the truth is, guys, of ourselves, we have not one single leg to stand on in God's court. Nothing. It's not that we can give a little defense. The fact of the matter is we can't give any defense at all. None. We can't justify one blasted thing we've done wrong. And let me tell you something, we don't have to defend ourselves before God. Because we have a defender. His name is Jesus. Paul says this, if God is for us, who is against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for all of us, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? Who will bring a charge against God's elect? God is the one who justifies. Who is the one who condemns? Christ Jesus is he who died, yes, rather who was raised, who is at the right hand of God, who also intercedes. See, Jesus was silent before Pilate's court, but Jesus is not silent before God's court. He speaks for you. He is your defender. What's called your intercessor? It is. and it will be so. Now, can you think of one reason why you should ever have to defend yourself to other people? Seriously. We get offended so easily, don't we? I mean, we really do. We want other people to think we have a thick skin, but we don't. People can say something about us and it just cuts us to the core. But what I'm telling you guys is anytime you try to defend yourself, you're wasting your wind. It's not necessary. Because Jesus defends you. And that's all that matters. Everything else will fall away into the dust. But not him. He will always be the one who defends you. Always.